Okay, this is Dialogue Conspiracy for another Saturday afternoon with Mae Brussel and her guest Paul Krasner. So why don't you just take it away immediately, Mae?
Paul, take it. It's all yours.
Chet. Well, it really feels good to be back on radio. I was on for 7 months in San Francisco and got fired after 7 months because I went to all pre-programmed music. And I was doing what's called free form, and which is what you do, except in a specialized area. But I think there's a relationship between why I got fired and the kind of thing you talk about on this show, which is that essentially the country is run by a conspiratorial shadow government. And I don't think people realize the insidious shrewdness that those people have and the levels to which they reach. And one of the things that I discovered in my own research was that Goebbels, who did the... Is that the way it's pronounced?
Yeah, I call him by another name.
Oh, well, yeah.
I'll be off the air.
You know how the FCC is about real names.
Okay.
To protect the guilty. But Goebbels always sounds to me like those little hamsters that you have anyway. Anyway, Goebbels was a practicing Gurdjieffian, and you know, people always think that, and Gurdjieff is a kind of spiritual teacher, and people always think that these people were just pure sadists, and yet Gurdjieff is a kind of, represented a kind of game playing, but you can carry game playing on at a very amoral level, and this was what he did as Minister of Propaganda. And I think that there's almost linear connection between you know, control of the media and why I got fired and why they go into more and more pre-programmed music to get people into a certain rhythm.
To get away from talking things out.
To getting away from using your imagination.
Well, didn't you write up in The Realist about KLRB having the courage, you know, to have this kind of a program? It's one of the few stations in the United States that would have a dialogue on facts and evidence that indicate conspiracy.
The only one other ones I know are the listener-sponsored stations in the Pacifica Network.
And even they don't go that far. I've contacted them at different times. They go within a certain set limit of what they can talk about.
Yeah, but it was on WBAI in New York when I interviewed you. They kept you on for 4 hours and then played it again.
That was, yeah, great.
But that was unusual.
They didn't ask for a weekly show, though, after that.
Oh, well, I'm sure they'd be willing to. Yeah, we'll send them a copy of this tape.
Let's see how it goes. But I think it is a rare opportunity to be able to have a dialogue about evidence that you see in the newspaper or in books that you read or documentation with the archives that points to conspiracies and be able to share it with the people that are listening and give them the reference where they can look it up and talk about it.
Well, since this past week was the Democratic Convention, we thought together that we agreed that it might be interesting just to put that through the... See, there's a filter that I've discovered. People have different filters. And so any event, there was an event in today's news about John Kennedy Jr., and eight individuals in Greece, the Greek government said that they were arrested for an attempted conspiracy to kidnap John Kennedy Jr.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, you can start, if you're a conspiracy theorist, as you are, you might see that as, aha, this is a way of spreading the fear, especially when it comes out that they're now accusing some new left group of doing it.
Oh, because they've been called extremists and radicals, and,
right.
and look
to,
what they'll do. Yeah.
Just to spread that paranoia.
Uh-huh.
There are probably, though, some really America firsters, you know, ultra super conservative patriots who might see that as, yeah, the new lefters are doing it again. There are probably new lefters who are seeing it and say, ah, there's subdivisions. Some of them say, oh, that's a good thing. We'll finally, you know, we'll get some money for the cause that way. And others saying it's a trap. So through the conspiracy filter, which you've built up over your 9 years of research, how what's happened in the past few days in Miami, how would it go through that filter?
Well, the Miami thing was completely altered by the Watergate arrest. You know, that's been on my mind for 3 weeks. And the men that were arrested in Washington, D.C., the five men that were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, and the four who fled were so terribly important to the structure of the government and to the hiring of provocateurs and setting the stage for violence at the elections that it completely altered the climate of Miami. I think that the people that were there I kept saying for months before the conventions, if they just sat on their hands and didn't do anything and kept quiet, the only people making scenes with violence would be the provocateurs. But when you have the money man, like Mr. Barker, arrested and in jail with $89,000 of cash, you know, which is CIA $100 bills, and he is paying provocateurs in Miami, everybody's scared, afraid to be associated with them. They blow their cover, and if they're arrested and their fingers like, oh, you're a provocateur, what are they going to do? It changed the complete plans of the election scene for the Republican convention. It's going to change the Democratic convention. What happened at the Watergate Hotel is going to change the street scene terribly. I don't know if it'll change the long-range plans, but the actual physical assault or the beating, the television studios were very depressed because it was what they said, a dull occasion. And they had advertised, you know, Cronkite and the others will be on the radio a certain amount of hours, except if something comes in that's unforeseen. And they were hoping that there'd be all the clubbing and the scene in Chicago. They would get down to this good news coverage and maybe people killed and so forth. But there was just a minimum of that, an absolute minimum of it. And I feel that the arrests were so significant because the high level of them, that the word went down and they were really being watched in Miami and they were afraid to step forward. And because, for one thing, if they step forward and they're linked to the people that are arrested, it makes the case even tighter. You see, there was an article in the paper just today about the group from the veterans from Vietnam that were down in Miami, and they were going to provoke violence for the 1972 conventions for the Republicans. But they've been arrested on a conspiracy charge in Tallahassee, Florida. This group was going to cause riots at the Republican convention. And the paper said it was part of a conspiracy that the defends the individual co-conspirators would organize numerous fire teams to attack with automatic weapons, fire and incendiary devices, police stations, police cars, and stores in Miami on various dates between August 21st and 24th. Well, they were listed and arrested for 15 overt acts. Well, these men were found this week for what they're going to do then, and the men that were hired for this election were not rioting because they'd be linked if they were paid for this. People don't go out and do this for nothing. They're paid for it. If any of the money was linked to the men that were arrested, you know, look what would happen to the case. It's tight enough as it is now. They're sitting with a hot potato. So I think the Miami thing was very calm, and I don't think a lot of people wanted it to be that calm. You see what happened when the hippies and all the young people, the music lovers got together at Woodstock. They had a phenomenon of masses of people making it together that even the establishment press couldn't get over. The lack of violence with mud and rain and uncomfortable conditions. So they followed it with a planned clandestine thing like the Altamont to show and photograph to show that they're not all love and beauty. Well, the Republican convention was going to be blood and guts, but I think the Democratic was too. But with the arrest at the Watergate Hotel, maybe you can explain. I assume that everyone knows what we're talking about there. Maybe just give a little background.
The Watergate Hotel? Yeah.
Explain, because don't you think that was an important thing in the climate of the convention? Do you feel it was?
I think it's one aspect. See, I think there are several aspects.
Yeah.
Of the filters that I see it through is as a one of the original founders of YPI.
Yes.
Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and I were, I suppose, the three original founders, whatever that means. All it means is that, in my case, particularly since I gave the name to it, I just gave a label to a phenomenon that already existed. In fact, that repression helped create as a kind of political backlash. But I was disappointed in statements that Abby and Jerry had been making in Miami, promising that there would be no disruption of the Democratic convention, because the implication of that is that if anything happens at the Republican convention, they're responsible. Or if anything happened in 68 in Chicago, that they were responsible.
Well, it was
it's like an admission by indirection.
Why did they say we'll be quiet at the Democratic convention, but we'll break loose at the Republican? Why did they make that statement?
I don't know. One of the other statements was, if you can only come to one convention, come to the Republican convention.
Why? Why were they going out for the Republicans?
Well, because the Democrats have been out of power for 4 years, and they said that there were progressive forces in it, and to the extent that McGovern did get nominated, I suppose that's progressive. I don't know about the... Well, I don't know about the vice president, because you talk about Spiro Agnew as being a deal in in the case of Nixon's having him as a running mate in 68. Do you think that there's any kind of parallel with in the case of Tom Eagleton?
Well, I looked up as much as I could in the last few days his voting record or his opinion on certain domestic problems and the Vietnamese problem. And I felt that I feel that McGovern pretty well knew his background. They've been close friends, and their ideas are exactly parallel, you know, and that he didn't surface his name earlier. But I'm sure that Ted Kennedy and Eagleton were very close, too, and I'm sure that they meant to introduce a name if McGovern got the nomination. But if they mouthed it earlier, there'd be a lot of coming down on him, and people would be taken to look up in advance his position on Vietnam. A lot of the Wallace people and the Johnson Democrats and the Ohio people would all come down. So they had a good man in the wings, but they just didn't blow it by exposing the name earlier. They let all the other names be exhausted, and then they brought him in. But I don't think it was, I think it was a complete break with the old political deal, like John Kennedy backing away in 1960 and not taking a liberal partner with him and saying, real greedy, like, I need those Texas votes, therefore I'll take Lyndon, or the backroom deals, let's take the Pendergast, the machine. It wasn't that kind of a deal. It was put, you know, out where it should be, where people had a choice, which is much less of a deal than announcing, this is who I'm going to take. And I sent a letter to every single member of Congress and the Senate 2 years ago in 1970 on the problem of selecting the vice president of the United States, that it was outrageous that when a man gets nominated, that he automatically says, and that I want this man. And I've sent out letters since that time, since 1970, to public officials and spoken about it. I just think it's disgusting that it should be something on the floor where everyone has a choice. And I think you can't say there was a deal here to force people to take him.
Well, originally he said he was going to leave it open to the convention. But by giving his choice, that's like a Jewish mother saying, okay, you can go to college or you don't have to. It's up to you. I don't care.
But never see me again.
Right.
But don't come home, and if I die of a heart attack next year, you know, don't come to my funeral. Put the whole story
in. Or if you come to my funeral, get a haircut.
Yeah, we get a haircut.
But anyway, you said before, because you just mentioned something, which is the tip of the iceberg of your research, and you said, did people make that association? And you were talking about the Watergate conspiracy in relationship to the Democratic Convention. Let me just refer to a couple of clippings I have, and just to bring that up to date. One of them is, this was from the Washington Post, and the headline, and headline writers are another breed.
Yeah.
The headline is, Martha Mitchell Happy Now. Now, if you read it, she's saying inside, I'm still a political prisoner.
But she's a happy one.
She said, I can't talk long. I am calling surreptitiously. Right? A happy act to call on a sneak.
Yeah.
When pressed as to whether Mitchell's resignation as President Nixon's reelection campaign director had made her happy, she said, quote, sure, that's what I wanted. But in the next paragraph, it says, Mrs. Mitchell said she was calling from her home in Washington's exclusive Watergate apartments. She also said she wondered why no one had asked a question about her at President Nixon's news conference last week, adding, quote, I've been a prisoner for so long, but a happy one.
Right?
Then Mrs. Mitchell hung up the telephone abruptly, right? Happily, but abruptly.
The headline says she's happy now.
Yeah.
She sneaks to the phone, and she's still a prisoner, but she's a happy.
Then the other one is...
Do you think the visit of the Army psychiatrist, you know, so many times in Rye, New York, could make her happy? Do you think any medication there made her happy?
Well, you know, sure, the way... There's drugs now which can affect your memory with hypnotism.
Yeah.
And so... You know, that's like asking somebody who has had a prefrontal lobotomy if they're happy, you know.
She can't talk long on the phone, but she's happy.
Yeah, well, you know, she didn't use the word happy. The question was put, did the resignation of her husband make her happy? And she said, sure, that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
But anyway, the other clipping is about one of the suspects, James W. McCord, who was found in the Watergate, wanting F. Lee Bailey to represent him.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is it says that Bailey had been asked last week by Democratic Chairman Larry O'Brien to represent the Democrats in their civil suit against the Republicans, but apparently turned down the offer.
That's interesting, that Bailey would be asked by the Democrats. Well, you see, at that level, Larry O'Brien there's no difference between Republican and Democrat at the high level. They're going to scratch each other's back. They have so much dirt on each other. And I refer to Larry O'Brien as the original body snatcher. You know, he's the one that took John Kennedy's body off the table at Parkland Hospital, and the coffin almost fell on the floor in the process. He grabbed it with Kenny O'Donnell, and the judge was there, and the coroner, and they insist on doing the autopsy of John Kennedy in Dallas. And they said, this is a plain homicide like anybody else. And he said, oh, no. And they had been in the back room with Lyndon Johnson, Kenny O'Donnell, who said, get the body to Maryland forthwith, you know, get on the plane. So they obeyed the orders, and by sending that body to back to Maryland, we never really have found out yet how many holes were in that body. And Kenny O'Donnell has been a part of a really bad team as far as John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy's assassination. He's part of the other team, you know, the thing that I wrote for him in The Realist mentions that Republicans and Democrats are both in the conspiratorial limit. In fact, I was just reading this afternoon just a little bit more of the Galen book and how Reinhard Galen, the Nazi general, came over to America after World War II and went right to the Pentagon, where he met with Alan Dulles and Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and Schlesinger was in on the bringing of Galen. Now, Schlesinger has infiltrated the McGovern camp. He was out here speaking for McGovern. He's Central Intelligence Agency. And F. Lee Bailey comes from the Central Intelligence Agency. I have documentation about his being sent from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, out to the space agencies to represent intelligence agent cases. So the Democrats are as guilty of intelligence work and using the espionage lawyer. He could take either side. It wouldn't matter because they are not going to go very far in this case unless the citizens demand the truth.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about it, and you mentioned before, you said that these men obviously had CIA money, and you know, I can imagine somebody listening saying, what does she mean they obviously had CIA money? But here's something connected with that that may help you to expand on it. They're talking in this clipping, also from the Washington Post, about of the five people who were arrested, only McCord, who was the highest one up, was let out. Now, the others, the judge has refused for a third time to release one defendant, Virgilio Gonzalez, because of what he said was inadequate information on the source of his $4,000 bail money.
Oh?
And then also, another man charged in the case, Eugenio Martinez, could be released on $40,000 bond as soon as information concerning various bank accounts in Miami could be verified. And then the two other defendants, Bernard Barker and Frank Sturgis, remain in the Washington, D.C. jail, awaiting an appeal on the judge's decision to deny them release until the source of their $40,000 and $50,000 bonds could be identified.
You see, Barker was the conduit of funds for the Bay of Pigs invasion, and he was holding $89,000 cash in $100 bills. 6,500 of them were in his pocket. And he won't tell where that came from, and originally it was in the Republican National Bank in Miami, and that was traced to Mexico, and that's been traced to Chile. And he says the socialist government, you know, would come down on him if he told where it comes from, which means it must be ITT money, and they don't want Chile to know how much ITT is, you know, siphoning in. The ITT plays in this case. It's going to come into this case, too. But if it's CIA money, this is the way you lose. I spoke about that last week's show, the money game, the money circle. Barker's unable to tell where he got the $89,000 cash, so he may sit in jail for a while. But as long as he's holding that cash, there can't be many provocations down in Miami for the Democrats or the Republicans, because who's going to pay them?
Uh-huh. Well, isn't there more money where that came from?
Yeah, but it's going to be spotted. See, these consecutive, the minute he was handing out money down in Miami before they were arrested, they called it CIA money. He gave one man $700 to be on the streets at the time of the convention.
Well, are you saying that, like, okay, with an elaborate plot like this, why would they have a judge like James Belson in there, who is isn't cooperating with the conspiracy. He's refusing to let these men out of jail until the source of their bail money is revealed. I mean, so just to get us off the track or what?
Well, in an elaborate plot like that, you don't choose your judge in case you're caught. You can choose your lawyer, but you can't choose your judge.
Uh-huh.
See? John Mitchell and Patrick Ray can choose.
Judges don't get assigned? Judge Hoffman didn't get assigned to Chicago?
Oh, yes, for the larger case. This is just on the bail thing. This isn't for the lawsuit.
Uh-huh.
See, the judge is Judge Titus has been named to handle the larger lawsuit. He's handpicked. He did the U.S. The Washington crime bill in 1970. But the immediate arrest, where they're put in, that's just a lower court.
Can't be put on him?
Well, they can't pick every judge. They just took these guys off to the nearest jail, and the judge on there, they were sure they'd get out on bail because this is a very prominent man from Miami, and he has prominent influence. He always bragged about his contacts in the White House, but he still has to tell where he's getting all his money. The judge is suspicious.
If you want a suspicious judge, the one that's suspicious to me automatically is Judge Charles R. Ritchie of the U.S. District Court, because he denied a request, I'm reading, by the Democratic National Committee that it be allowed immediately to question the five arrested defendants. And then he explains, he says, Judge Ritchie ruled that the Democrats and their chairman, Lawrence O'Brien, quote, have failed to make the required showing that some unusual circumstances or conditions exist for the speedy questioning.
Oh, he wouldn't allow it.
He said there's nothing unusual about this.
That's the judge that I wrote about in the article that said he doesn't want it brought up on the case whether it's a Democratic or Republican issue, that it's not a political problem about...
Okay, then one more clipping,
yeah.
And then I'll get through these. This is a telegram that Democratic or ex-Democratic Chairman O'Brien sent to President Nixon asking him to authorize a special investigation of they still call it the alleged attempt to bug the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee. And he had previously sent a letter, which was never responded to. So now in the telegram, O'Brien says that the president had not chosen to reply to the first request, and he added that he had been informed that Mr. Nixon referred the matter to the Committee for the Re-election of the President as a political matter.
Oh, really? As a political matter? They're recognizing that it is a political matter. Yeah.
But nevertheless, now this guy, Kenneth Clausen, who's the Deputy Director of Communications for the Executive Branch, said he did not know what the President did with the first request.
Oh, it got lost. Well, I classify that under denial.
Uh-huh.
Nobody knows what happens to information that comes to them, and nobody knows the people that are being fingered.
But then beyond the denial, he even goes further. He says also that the president has no responsibility to respond to it in the first place.
That's
so
true.
We don't know where it is, but even if we had it, we don't have to answer it.
The whole case is very quiet now, and I meet people, and I've sort of been in seclusion writing that article on the Watergate thing, and I came out after about 3 weeks, you know, like, where have you been? And I've been writing about the Watergate Hotel, and they say, well, oh, fresh my memory, what happened there? And
oh, right. Watergate is just just another word, you know, is that where...
Here was the top man of the Central Intelligence Agency. I suppose after Richard Helms, who's the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, James McCord has to be the second most important, because he was the chief of all security of the grounds, and... To collect information is one thing, but to protect the grounds is the important thing, you know, to keep it secure so that other people don't get in or out. And he was the chief of all intelligence there, and then he was assigned chief of intelligence for John Mitchell's committee to reelect Richard Nixon. And then the important job was in Miami to secure the Miami conventions. And this is where these people coming in now with the bombs and the automatic weapons and the guns will be arrested, because they have to make it secure and not allow it to happen. They have to say, oh, we didn't want that to take place.
Well, what do you call them? Do you have a name for something like the switch of the resignation of John Mitchell?
I call it the step down.
The step down?
The step down, you know, I call it the Nixon administration step down. When the people who are suspect are going to be investigated, they just step down and hope that you'll forget that they're there.
Well, they're saying the case of John Connolly, was that a step down for a different reason?
That was manipulation.
Yeah.
I put the John Connolly step down into a, 5 weeks ago when I talked about the barbecue that John Connolly had, and I said that was the War Council. mm-hmm. with Nixon and Johnson and Connally. And after that, J. Edgar Hoover was dead. And there's a lot of evidence. I have a letter here from Justine from Germany, his newsletter on the murder of J. Edgar Hoover. A lot of people believe that he was murdered. And this is about that car that took Hoover's body away. J. Edgar Hoover died. George Wallace was shot. John Connally has been traveling around handing messages because there's no secret memos that can go through anymore that are trusted. And Rogers has been in these different countries. The importance of Connally cannot be underestimated. And again, the Watergate thing presents a whole new picture because I was under the assumption that Nixon would be killed before the elections and that John Connally and Agnew would be the team that would be running things. And that Connally was stepping around and reappraising and lining up positions because he had a very important position in the state of Texas as far as the John Kennedy assassination goes. And
my feeling on that was always that he might not have been part of the conspiracy, but he became it after he made deals to keep quiet about which direction he was hit from by bullets himself.
No, as Secretary of the Navy, he had a very important part with Lee Oswald. It was just a fluke that he was hit. The marksman missed, and it hit him in his crossfire. But he was sort of like the Manchurian candidate sitting there, you know, not expecting to be hit. But John Connally's role was very important in the assassination of... so was Fred Korth, who was Secretary of the Navy after Connally, who then got the contract for the F-111 General Dynamics in Texas. There was a whole network of Texas people that were very important to Lyndon Johnson in the assassination of John Kennedy.
Well, it comes out in this little clipping, which, again, you know, I just happened to see it, and it was the Washington Post's own foreign service from Buenos Aires, and it's talking about... John Connally talking about the role of the U.S. State Department. And this Chairman Arthur Burns of the Federal Reserve Bank says, "In general, Mr. Connally has felt that the State Department has not attended to U.S. financial affairs sufficiently."
What does that mean?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they're, it's just like pushing his image further and further. You know, now he's making points about the State Department. The other thing was about Mitchell, even though you call it the step-down, is there another name category you have for it when it's a step-down with it's only a front?
Because it's in the same office.
Well, yeah, in this clip it says President Nixon worked, this is July 2nd, President Nixon worked on the strategy and tactics of his reelection effort today and telephones his just-resigned campaign manager, John Mitchell, to, quote, express his understanding of Mitchell's decision.
Yeah,
his understanding may have been that we'll keep asking you for
stuff. Well, he talks to him every day.
Uh-huh,
I mean, there's nothing different, but the point is that he does not head the committee, and the committee is sued for $1 million. He did give up the Justice Department as the Attorney General, which is a very important position, to become the head of the committee to reelect Richard Nixon. And that committee has this secret funding that we're going to hear a lot about, and McGovern mentioned it in his acceptance speech, and I've written about it, you know, for your articles in The Realist, on the secret funding of Richard Nixon, the clandestine agent. And John Mitchell works very closely with that firm, Robert Mullen, and the whole group that raised, they say, $10 million. We don't know how much they've raised for Richard Nixon in secret funds. I mean, the over the table, they can get a lot. But he was doing a lot of work up till April, getting that $10 million, you know, wrapped up that he refuses to tell anybody about. And I think in the lawsuit, they're going to have to disclose. I don't think he's going to be allowed to keep that secret, this truth of this money, to find out if it really, in fact, went to Chile, to Mexico, to Miami, and back to the Watergate Hotel. They're going to have to prove it didn't, say, that this $89,000 didn't come from that $10 million. They're going to have to prove the source of where this came from, you see, the financing of this money circle game. But John Mitchell stepped down. Now, he still runs the FBI because we have no head of the FBI. His office is right next door. The law office is right next door to the committee to reelect. He can give the same advice, but he can't have the interviews. He isn't the figurehead. And anybody that associates with the group can be investigated. See, it is a step down because everybody is suspecting every penny that comes to them. Nixon asked this week, please don't have a lawsuit until after the elections because people will hesitate to give money. Darn right they will because they've been giving under phony friends and phony names. What if they're called in? Ralph Nader did an investigation on the funding of the Richard Nixon and claimed that $365,000 went from the Milk Group, Milk Association, to the committee to investigate Richard Nixon, then Nixon raised the prices of milk so that they could get their money back through the cost of milk. See, and give the money to the Nixon campaign.
Listen, there's a lot. The level of cynicism. I spoke to somebody who is a former gun mole. You know, the ex girlfriend of a gangster, and she said her immediate reaction was, "I wonder what the government is putting into all that milk that they're pushing it on all those commercials now."
Oh, really?
Well, that's just—it was an interesting suspicion.
Yeah.
I have to do a station break. Okay. This is KLRB in Carmel.